Welcome to the Statesman Journal's Explore Oregon podcast. I'm your host, Zachary Ness, and in each episode, we highlight Oregon's most beautiful and interesting places. In today's show, we're returning to a conversation that I had with a woman who broke the speed record on the Oregon segment of the Pacific Crest Trail. She finished 460 miles in 7 days, 19 hours, and 20 minutes. To set the record for both male and female runners. We're bringing that conversation back because Emily just published a book about her amazing run and is heading out on a book tour. Before we get rolling, I want to highlight the sponsors of this podcast that make it possible for us to hire and pay our outdoor journalism interns every spring, summer, and fall. Our first sponsor is the American Forest Resource Council, supporting responsible forestry on public lands throughout the Pacific Northwest. Learn more at amforest.org. We're also supported by Visit Tillamook Coast, a land of ocean and forest just an hour from the Willamette Valley that this spring will offer special volunteer vacations designed for visitors to spend a day doing a stewardship project and another headed out on a Tillamook Coast adventure. We'll have more details on this a little bit later in the show. Finally, we're brought to you by the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department that reminds visitors to leave no trace and buy local firewood when camping at state parks to limit the spread of invasive insects. All right, up next, we're going to talk to ultra trail runner Emily Halnan about the Pacific Crest Trail. But first, here's some guitar music to get us rolling. All right, in this podcast, we're revisiting one of my favorite conversations. This one was with ultra athlete Emily Halnan of Eugene, who set the record for the fastest known time on the Oregon segment of the Pacific Crest Trail. In a story I wrote and in this podcast, Emily talks about how she was inspired by her mother, who died of a rare form of cancer at just 66 years old, but about how her mother's fight and her spirit helped inspire Emily to take on gigantic challenges. This interview first aired in 2021, and since then, Emily has written a book about the experience. It's called To the Gorge: Running, Grief, Resilience, and 460 Miles on the Pacific Crest Trail. There were a few things I really enjoyed about Emily's story. First, just athletically, she was running 57 miles each day in remote mountain wilderness, climbing and losing thousands of feet. Like, I can't even imagine doing that. Like, for me, like, backpacking the PCT, I'm lucky if I get 10, 15 miles. Maybe I could get 20, maybe. But there's no way I could ever do anywhere close to what she was doing. So just the athleticism stands out. But the thing that was always fun is that she kept it fun. You know, she had dance parties on the trail, she involved her friends, and one of my favorite details was the way she had to remind herself to eat just an incredible amount, not of like health food or anything, but of junk food. Like, she talks at length about the amount of just junk food she was pouring into her body to keep it fueled enough to do this incredibly difficult thing. So the book is chock full of this kind of stuff. It's going to be a fun read, and this is a fun conversation. The book is in stores now, and Emily is doing a little tour. She'll be at Powell's Bookstore on May 6th and Dudley's Bookstore and Cafe in Bend on May 16th. You can find her full dates at emilyhalnan.com/tour. Okay, so here's the conversation. All right, well, I'm here today with Emily Halnan, who last summer set the record for the fastest time ever recorded on the Oregon section of the Pacific Crest Trail. Emily ran, hiked, trudged 455 miles in about a week while raising over $32,000 for rare cancer research and the Brave Like Gabe Foundation. I wrote a pretty long story about her journey last summer, and I'm thrilled to be joined by her today. Emily, how's it going?
Great, Zach. I'm thrilled to be here with you today. All right, so it's been 7 months since you set this record, finished that journey. You're running in honor of your mother, who'd recently passed away. How do you look back on that immense feat, everything that came with it? Has time and space, like, given you a chance to allow it to sink in?
No. Not fully, no. It's funny, I could not have told you it was 7 months. I'm glad that you did the math on that.
Yeah.
We're like hitting the year anniversary of the pandemic starting and starting to really affect our lives. And when I look back on being able to run the PCT across Oregon over the summer, I feel a lot of gratitude for the fact that in a year that has been so hard for so many reasons, like you said, I was doing it after losing my mother. And I've also lost my sister-in-law in the last year also to cancer. And the fact that through such a like horribly hard and stressful year, I was able to do something that stands out as one of the most meaningful and joyful things that I've done. And like you said, was able to raise all this money for rare cancer research at the same time. I appreciate that I have this like bright spot that that defined a lot of last year amidst all of the horrible stuff that we've all been enduring.
That was, I think, one of my favorite things. That's one of the things that drew me to the story and then like drew a lot of readers to the story, was that it was like this fun. It wasn't anything to do with the pandemic. It wasn't anything to do with wildfires that would come later. It was just like this really fun, cool story. What was the feedback that you got when people started kind of knowing your name and stuff?
Yeah. No, I think like it was funny. I was tracking the entire run through a satellite Garmin system. And so people could follow along. And I think like as live as 10-minute increments of my progress on the trail. And I was shocked at how many people were following my dot, moving at what like should seem like this little snail's pace across the entire state of Oregon. But I think they were doing that because, like you said, it was, and just being engaged with my story and with the fundraising effort in general, because people were so hungry for something that was just like purely positive and good and not defined by the pandemic or the ways that our lives had changed for negative reasons. And
and it also felt like, I mean, you know, you were very active on like Instagram and stuff, and it felt like if you were like tracking your progress and reading those posts, like you could sort of like live through your experience a little bit.
I think so. And my boyfriend was posting like Instagram stories and that kind of, like, and they, and a lot of, I tend to as much as I may be suffering or in pain or tired during these things, I also try to infuse a fair amount of fun into them. And so I think like he was posting a lot of videos of like my crew, like having dance parties at trail intersections. And so I think that people were like drawn to the ways that it was a like exciting thing to be following.
So I want to talk about the different legs of your run, because they're all, it's almost like little chapters in a story, but I want to start here. You averaged 57 miles per day. Now, I think I've backpacked 57 miles a few times in my life, usually over about 4 or 5 days. I guess my question is, like, to get to that point where you can do 57 miles in one day over mountains and stuff like that, what did you have to do in your background? Like, what kind of training? Like, how did you get to that point?
Yeah. I mean, I'll preface this by saying that I wasn't totally confident that I was at that point when I started the trail. I had never done anything like that before, so it was a little bit of unknown territory, as was training for it, because it was something that was like so big. So I think like when we chatted for the story you wrote last summer, I said that I had been training for it for like 7 or 8 years or even longer. And I think that's true both physically and maybe more importantly mentally, is that I had done so many big adventure runs or races. I think I've now done like 5 100-milers, and I've done a lot of the big adventure runs, like running across the Grand Canyon and back and running around Mount Hood and Mount Rainier and the Three Sisters and all of that. So I think like all of that cumulative experience of experiencing the fatigue that sets from so many miles, and knowing that I could endure that, and knowing the ways that I need to like train my mind to help me endure that. And then, you know, last year when I decided to do this run, I certainly trained with some intention and did a lot of running. But I talk about my training like finding the sweet spot of what would get me physically strong without breaking me, which is kind of a guessing game and a gamble. And so, but I think obviously it worked. I found what felt like a sustainably high volume of running for me, and I was able to maintain that through running last summer. And in that I did, kind of the strategy with getting ready for really big runs is that you find ways to get kind of stupidly tired and keep running so that you experience that you can do that both physically and mentally. So I think I told you, like, we did a like triple hardesty. If people listening are familiar with hardesty, is like a 3,300 foot climb outside of Eugene, and we did it three times in a row, which is also just like mundane and dumb, and like it challenges you to like keep going past what feels like fun and reasonable. So things like that were part of the training effort to get ready for it.
But you were athletic your whole life, and your mom was a big influence on your running. So, but it also came like later in life. So take me through her journey and how she was into athletics and got into running and inspired you later.
Yeah, I would love to. My mom is every reason that I became a runner. She, when I was growing up, was not super active. And when I was a teenager, she had a health scare and had to have her gallbladder removed. And that inspired her to become more active. And so at that point, she was in her late 40s. And she started walking for fitness, and you know, she would just walk a mile at a time at first. And then it's probably not a surprise that my family has some kind of competitive gene in us. And so she eventually started race walking and got super into it, and was you know, competitive in whatever way made sense for her. And then she started running 5Ks, and then she started running 10Ks. And the year she turned 50, she ran her first marathon. And I watched that, and it was pretty hard to not feel very inspired by watching my 50-year-old mother transform into a marathon runner. And so I decided I was going to try and run a marathon myself. And I did that a few years after she ran her first marathon. And she, as soon as I decided that, wanted to run it with me. So we went to Washington, D.C. together from Vermont, is where I grew up. And my mom was on her fourth marathon at the time, and she ended up beating me by 20 minutes in that marathon. I had started off just very foolishly and went out way too fast. And I remember around the halfway mark, I saw my mom run by, and it was the Marine Corps Marathon, so it was so crowded. And I was just desperately yelling to her, like, "Mom, mommy, mom." And she just kept going. She didn't hear me, and she ended up beating me by 20 minutes. And then she got into triathlons when she turned 60. She learned how to swim and got into triathlons. So she just kind of stayed endlessly bold in her athletic pursuits. And she was a lot of the reason that I did the same in chasing kind of bigger and bigger things, and that I wanted to do this run in honor of her was for that.
Yeah, I mean, I remember you talking about wanting to do something big. You know, after she passed away, was it always going to be the Pacific Crest Trail? Was that something that stuck out? How did you decide that was my big thing?
Yeah, it was, for whatever reason that these things happened, it was the obvious answer. When I lost her, I knew I wanted to do something big for her, for that reason that she was so bold, and she continued after she was diagnosed with cancer. She just lived in the most beautiful, beautiful way. She had cancer for about 13 months before she passed, and she continued to stay astonishingly active through all of her treatment, and she just found ways to still be joyful despite having this really grim diagnosis. And so when she passed away, I knew I wanted to do something in that spirit, and running across Oregon on the PCT and trying to do it faster than anyone else was just the thing that immediately stood out as what I would do. And I think it's probably because I moved out to Oregon about 7 years ago, and it's where I've become a trail runner. It's where I've become a long distance trail runner, and the PCT has been a part of that in a lot of different ways. And I think being able to celebrate how meaningful the Pacific Northwest and the trails here have been in my life was something that felt really important and wonderful. And I remembered hearing about when Brian Donnelly did this run back in 2013, and I think that kind of planted the seed. But like, I remember when he did the run, I did the math on how many miles he must have run each day, and I was just getting into trail running at the time, and I was just like, well, that's dumb. I can't actually do that. But you know, 7 years later, I'm a different runner, and it seemed slightly less outlandish, though still kind of outlandish, which was the point.
Yeah. So we talked about the speed record, and what we're really referencing is this idea of the fastest known time community, which is a pretty big website and a place where people post and provide the times for I think it's hundreds of different challenges.
Like, not more.
It runs a wide gamut too, from like well-known speed records for like the entire PCT, and then like really obscure kind of random trails and stuff. But it's not enough to just like say you've done these records. Like, you have to prove it. So what were the some of the things that you did in setting up to be like, okay, I'm going for the fastest known time? But you have to do a number of different things, so take me through that a little bit.
You do, yeah. It requires some accountability. So one thing that they encourage, I think, period, but require for especially notable routes, is that you announce your intention ahead of time so people do have the opportunity to follow along. And I announced my run ahead of time for multiple reasons, but that was certainly one of them. And then I think you have to track it. I would have to go back and actually double check this, but I think that you have to track it through multiple devices, or at least like it's a smart idea too. So I had both my Garmin inReach tracking me, and then I also I had always been very proud that I didn't run with a watch. That was like a thing I never did, or I used to a long time ago, but haven't in a long time. I was just like, data, it doesn't matter. And I bought a watch, and now I use it all the time. So I got myself a GPS, Coros GPS watch for the run, and tracked via that too, and uploaded everything to Strava. And then you also are encouraged, maybe required to, I think required to take photos that could show a timestamp, and then write a report afterward and include the photos that have timestamps so that you can see where your progress is over the run. I think it's funny, when Brian did the run, I think there was less sophisticated tracking technology. So he actually like pre-printed like business cards essentially ahead of time and handed them out to trail runner, like or hikers, so that if someone questioned his record, he could be like, you saw me in the middle of this wilderness. And so yeah, they definitely, and unfortunately people have cheated for whatever reasons people cheat. And so there's been, I think, greater and greater stress placed on the accountability.
I feel like this community polices itself extraordinarily well.
Yeah, I had a section around like Mount Hood where I think there's maybe an old PCT and a new PCT or something. And there was like online commentary about like, she's not on the PCT. And I was, but like, it didn't look that way on the Garmin map. And it was funny that I was like, who is that? Like, who are these people who are?
They are out there.
Yeah.
They will keep you honest.
Yeah.
You know, you've done the preparation and the training. You're set up to track this. You've announced it. So, you know, you're about to do it. You go down to the Oregon-California border on August 1st, 2020. And then you just started running that first day, 60 miles, and then 70 miles the second day. What do you remember about that? It must have been a blur through Southern Oregon.
I wouldn't describe the whole thing as a blur. I would actually describe it as like glacially, painfully slow at times, just because it was so many miles. You know, it's funny. Day one and day two were drastically different. Like first day, yeah, so there was just a relief in being out there. And also obviously like after thinking about this run for so many months, it felt exciting to actually be doing it. I would say day two, that feeling vanished pretty quickly. And 70 miles felt like a lot from pretty much the very first mile. And it stayed a lot until the last, like the very last step of the day. Like even my boyfriend was pacing me through, I think, the last 17 miles of the day. And even when we were within like 2 miles of the trailhead, I thought we would like be there by now. And he'd be like, no, it's okay. We only have like 2 miles. And I was like, 2 miles? It felt so far. So it was a lot, but we got through it.
Well, one of the things that was fun about your story was it wasn't like a, you know, a joyless like trudge. There was, you know, it was a supported record and you had a big community around you, you know, helping you along. So what did your friends and family, you know, your boyfriend, what did they all bring to the table? Like, how did they support what you were doing?
Oh, in so many ways. So my boyfriend crewed the entire thing with our puppy, Dilly. He has an old, when I say van, you're going to picture like van life, nice sprinter, but it's not that. It's like a salvage van from the Friendsview retirement community and still heavily branded as such. So that was our base camp mobile. But I had, yeah, people, like you said, people, it was funny. I was like so scared to ask people to help. It's just hard to ask for help. And people were so excited to support in so many different ways. And so I had a lot of people who were eager to help me out. So I was paced almost every single mile of the run, and people ran anything from 2 miles with me to 60 plus miles with me. Some were there for multiple days. I also had like on day two, which was the 70 mile day, it was so hard. I had a couple of friends who were thru hikers and they wanted to help in their like thru hiking way. And there was so little access. That's part of why I had to do a 70 mile day. And so they hiked in and they were like, tell us what you want us to bring. And I was kind of like, would it be too much to like bring a jet boil so you can make me mashed potatoes? And they're like, Emily, this is what we do for fun all the time. Like, load us up. And so they put like a hammock and blankets and hiked in. And yeah, people just, I had friends that we talked about in our last conversation, friends who surprised me with what people would call trail magic, like surprise excitement on the trail. On my fourth day, they showed up with a Dairy Queen hot dog and French fries and a Powerade that they had put in their freezer the night before so it would stay cold when they found me on this hot summer day. And I had people plug in so many different wonderful ways, whether it was cheering or pacing or showing up with really helpful support. I was very supported in a really beautiful way.
I think one of my favorite stories was about the woman who had done the run before and she was pacing you for one of the days and like had touted the virtues of listening to romance novels while you're doing something like this. So you have to tell that story. It's just too good.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's also funny. I think what didn't come up in our conversation is the contrast with who was pacing me the next day. But yeah, so Danielle Snyder set the record on the PCT for women the summer before I ran it. And I reached out to her to connect with her before the run, and she immediately was just like, how can I help you? I'm so excited for you. And we are now very good friends. And she came down and she paced me for two of the days. And when she did the run the summer before, one of the things that she likes to do when she's on crazy long runs is listen to romance novels. And I think that's hilarious and wonderful. And I was just like, so she's going to show up, and when she's pacing me, she'll have romance novels on her phone downloaded and we can listen to them when like I need something to help me keep moving. And so she showed up to pace me and I was like, Danielle, you have to play me a romance novel. And she didn't have any downloaded on her phone for whatever reason. I was like, well, then you need to tell me a romance story. So she like invented a romance story that involved like random thru hikers and herself. And and this was like in the middle of the night in a burn zone. And she was telling me this great made up romance story. And then the next day I was paced by my friend Daniel, who is a new father. And when he started pacing me, he started proving that he could recite children's books from memory unprompted. So I went from romance novel to like hearing the stories that he reads his 2-year-old. So,
all right, we're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors. But when we return, we'll have more with Emily, including how she stays fueled on these extremely long distance challenging runs. So stay with us.
I'm Kristen Rasmussen with Hampton Lumber and Family Forests. We got our start back in 1942 with our first sawmill in Willamina, Oregon. Since then, we've grown along with global demand for sustainable building materials. We proudly manufacture much needed wood products right here in Oregon from some of the most sustainably managed forest resources on the planet. Healthy and productive working forests, both private and publicly owned, are key to our ability to produce lumber needed for building projects throughout the region. We're tinkerers, problem solvers, nurturers, and nature lovers, and we're proud members of AFRC, sponsor of the Explore Oregon podcast. Learn more at amforest.org.
This message is brought to you by Visit Tillamook Coast. The Tillamook Coast Visitors Association is excited to bring back their Volunteer Adventures program for 2024 that will welcome groups from inside or outside Tillamook County to lend a hand in stewardship programs while also having a good time. One example of an itinerary would be spending one day clearing invasive brush or working on a hiking trail. The next would include something like a guided hike or kayak trip, the type of activity that highlights the Tillamook area and shows why doing stewardship projects is so important. All meals, lodging, and activities are included. The program is designed to offer participants the opportunity to give back to our popular area while also learning the vital role stewardship plays in preserving our natural places. If you want more information or to sign up early, search for Tillamook Coast Volunteer Adventures or email Dan Hagg at dan@tillamookcoast.com. Once again, that email is dan@tillamookcoast.com. Our third and final sponsor is the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department that invites Oregonians to explore parks this fall and winter to experience the beauty of those seasons. If you're camping, remember to get firewood from sources local to your destination to avoid bringing invasive insects, such as the devastating emerald ash borer, into parks. This will help preserve the health of Oregon's forests for seasons to come. Learn more about protecting Oregon's ash trees at stateparks.oregon.gov.
All right, so one of the things that blew my mind about the trip and ultra running in general is figuring out how you guys get enough food to fuel this kind of undertaking. I mean, it almost sounds like as hard as the running itself is getting that food down. So first, what's an ultra runner's diet and what was yours like on this trip?
Yeah. We eat a lot of food. And I needed to eat a lot of food on this run. I will say I'm normally great at snacking and eating, and I struggled with it a little bit on the PCT. Danielle, who we just referenced, called herself my snack sheriff because she had to keep reminding me to eat, and I was begrudgingly following her orders. The food that we eat is generally pretty great. We eat a lot of real food, and probably what some people would label as junk food, but I don't think it's junk. So like I said, my friends brought me hot dogs actually on multiple occasions. I generally eat a lot of pizza. Quesadillas is like a really popular, like my boyfriend was making me a lot of quesadillas and we had like guacamole, so I was like adding guacamole to them. I eat a lot of like salty, snacky, like I love Cheetos, that's probably my favorite. Like trail snack chip and Fritos. Fritos are good. Maybe some Cool Ranch Doritos, Cheez-Its, Goldfish, lots of candy. I had a lot of like sour gummy worms and Skittles. Snickers is a popular candy. I had a lot of, this was a first for me, but it will not be a last. I had a lot of instant mashed potatoes on the trail and ramen, because those were both like things that you could make in a jet boil if people were hiking in to meet me that were hot. So that was like a sunset, it's cold, I'm not done running, this is easy to eat. My friend's mom, Pam Sheridan, shout out to Pam Sheridan, she made me carrot cake, and she makes inarguably the best carrot cake in the world, and so I had some carrot cake on the trail. All kinds of delicious stuff.
And is the idea just that you need to get calories, so it might as well be like enjoyable to eat, as opposed, because I feel like, you know, people who like think they're into the outdoors or are into the outdoors like have this idea that you have to have like a very like healthy, like it's got to be Cliff Bars or it's got to be like, you know, this specific kind of thing or something like that. And is that just a myth? Like, is that a marketing thing? What's going on?
I think it is a marketing
thing. Yeah.
I mean, if you think about what's in a gel versus what's in a bag of Skittles, I don't think that they're like, you're looking for like fast sugar either way. And Skittles are a much more enjoyable way to get fast sugar. I think I've also like doing 100 milers have, especially, or like long adventure runs have found that like, I just can't tolerate like gels. I learned that a long time ago. I have not had a gel in a really long time. Mm-hmm. Because I don't want to have just gels for hours. And so I think once you're out there for a long time, like you just really crave and need like a burrito bacon or just something other than just like a liquidy sugar in a tin package.
So when you're running 50 to 70 miles per day, I mean, every day is going to be big. It's not like there's going to be any small days, but can you kind of take us through like a morning, afternoon, and night? Like, when are you starting? You know, what's the day like? And then when are you usually getting into camp?
Yeah. So I would say I never started as early as I intended to. And I always started earlier than I wanted to. I probably aim to start at 5 every morning and maybe started closer to 6. I found that I usually had more to do in the morning than I had given myself time for, which largely was like bandaging my feet or doing something to like manage blisters. Or getting gear ready. I had to like stuff all the snacks we just talked about in my pack and fill water and get all my electronics going. So I would usually start around 6 o'clock. And then I would say each day was like an average day was maybe 16 hours. So trying to do the math on that, I would finish at like between 10 p.m. and midnight maybe, depending on when I started. And yeah, a typical day was running. And doing, like you said in the beginning, it was also hiking and trudging and all the motions that were propelling me forward and at some pace. One thing that was lovely about the Oregon PCT is pretty much every single day had like a really notable and wonderful landmark as part of it. And so I feel like that was how I thought about a lot of days was like, today I get to Mount Thielson and then I keep going. But it was like seeing Mount Thielson from the horizon and then getting to Mount Thielson and then putting Mount Thielson behind you. And so that felt like how I marked a lot of the days.
Sure.
And then also like how you get supported on the PCT is very determined by where roads or trails intersect with the PCT. And so that was a lot of how my day broke up too, was like, I see my crew in 30 miles and 30 miles later I would get to my crew. I might get a new pacer. I would definitely get new snacks, maybe a dance party. And then I would say that like pretty regularly, I mean, I had variations in how hard every day felt, but like pretty reliably the last 10 miles were like just pretty hard and stretched. Every mile does not feel like the same mile, and the last 10 miles usually felt a lot more significant.
I mean, you were doing a lot of running in the dark too. How did that change things? And was there concern about like hitting a rock or like how did you deal with that in the dark? Like, did you have a big headlamp on, or how? Take me through the nighttime section of it, because that would have been a lot.
Yeah, I definitely had a headlamp. I think I always had someone running with me at night, which was part of it. Night miles are just harder. It's your spirit sinks with the sun, and they're colder and darker and feel longer. You just want to be done. You're not seeing stuff, so you're not motivated by like the beauty you're running through. I mean, there were certainly like nice moments of the night, but they were generally a lot harder. But I did not suffer any catastrophic falls from tripping on rocks or anything.
70 miles, like that's a giant day. But you also mentioned that the hardest day was actually between McKenzie Pass through the Mount Jefferson Wilderness and Mount Washington. So take me through that day. Like what made that one so challenging?
Yeah, the weather was the biggest thing that made that day. Other things too. I mean, it was my sixth day on trail, so I was very tired and it still didn't feel like I was very close to being done. I had not anticipated having anything other than like summer weather. I was running the first week of August and that felt pretty guaranteed. There might be some fluctuations in how summery it was, but I was pretty much just ready for summer weather. And my friend Eric was pacing me for that entire day. And he is also who brought me the hot dog on day 4. And when I saw him, I was just like, I'm so psyched for our day. It's going to be so beautiful. Because like you said, it's Mount Washington to Three Finger Jack to Mount Jefferson. And like, even though it was supposed to be one of my longest days, I was just like, but it's going to be one of the prettiest. Like, I'm so excited for that day. And Eric was like, well, the weather doesn't look great. And I was like, what do you mean? And it turned out that there was what I would describe as a winter storm that had moved in that day. I think it's the most miserable weather that I've ever experienced on a run. And I think I was maybe the least prepared for it. I don't want to make it sound like I was being dumb out there, but I think you know, some weather is just hard to protect yourself against unless you're like running in like a, I don't even know, Gore-Tex shelter or something. So that day, a very precipitation heavy, very, very windy, very cold storm hit. And I saw my crew at mile 17, and the weather got significantly worse after I saw them. And so when I left them, I thought I was over-prepared for the weather. I had put on my actual rain jacket, which I like never run in, and was wearing quite a few layers, had a winter hat, had gloves. And I would say within a mile of leaving them, the weather just plummeted, and it was very apparent that nothing was maybe going to protect me from it. So I was pretty soaked. I was pretty cold, and the wind was so bad. It's a very exposed day, and we were on ridgelines for most of the day, and we legitimately were like having our balance threatened by how windy it was, like nearly falling over because the wind was so violent, and we were just soaked to our flesh, and also it was very cold, and there's just nothing you can do about those things when you're in the middle of the wilderness. And I think I had to go about, it was 30 miles, which I think it took us like 10 hours before we saw our crew again. And so just like knowing that you're that hopelessly uncomfortable and cold and wet and miserable with just nothing to do about it other than covering what felt like too much ground was very difficult.
So were you just getting pelted by like rain snow mix all day and then like into the night?
It was not a rain snow mix. It was, I think, just rain, but like a cold rain. But yeah, we were just getting pelted, and it let up by the time we saw our crew. But we still had, I think, 12 miles to go. And we saw them at about 10 p.m. And I like got into a sleeping bag and actually fell asleep. And Eric was like, "Emily, we've got to keep going."
Oh,
and
it
was one of those moments where I was like, "If I don't do this, I don't think I can get the record. And if I do this, I think I still have a chance."
Yeah.
And had to just keep going.
So you'd fallen asleep after a really long day of getting pelted by rain and in a cozy sleeping bag, and then had to wake up like in the darkness and then just keep running through the wilderness. That must have been like, how was that last stretch?
Horrible.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've ever been so mad. I was having some shin pain that day, and toward the end of the run, I actually wasn't totally sure I was going to keep going because the shin pain had gotten so bad. But so like every step toward the end, like I'm generally a pretty positive person, and I was like swearing. My friend Eric was like, "Nice job, Emily." And I was dropping words I probably can't say on your podcast in response. And we had to cross some pretty icy snowfields at the top of Mount Jefferson, not the top of Mount Jefferson, but as high as the PCT goes around Mount Jefferson. And because of that and some rocky terrain, the trail got really hard to follow. And so that was really slow. And then we were just like stumbling down this rocky descent into the campground as I was in a lot of pain. And it was just tripping. That day actually was tripping on rocks all over, just not falling. But yeah, I think we got into camp around 4:30 in the morning. So that was an especially long and horrible.
But honestly though, like the thing that stuck out, and when I talked to your friend about this, the thing that blew him away most was, okay, so you get into camp at 4:30 a.m. after this super long day, you get to sleep for 2 hours or something like that, and then you're up and doing it again. I mean, was there any point, like, especially there, where you're like, you know, I like this idea, but I don't know if I can keep going? Like, take me through that morning a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that morning was very hard because we had finished around 4:30 in the morning, and I was very physically exhausted. I was prepared to push through some stuff, but I was in a place with my shin where I wanted to make sure I wasn't like doing something really dumb to push through stuff. So I was like texting my physical therapist to get his opinion on whether or not I should keep going. So it was an emotional morning, feeling that threatened. But actually, I wonder if like having that also jeopardized by something like a physical injury was incurred, like was this like realization point of how much I wanted to keep going, that I didn't want to let something like that be the reason that I had to get off trail. But honestly, I think like the reason that I was out there to honor my mom made it almost a like, not even almost, it just was a to quit the trail for any reason other than like a broken shin was just not something I was going to be considering. And I mean, I thought about her a lot while I was out there, and it was a pretty powerful motivator to keep going and to do whatever I could to finish the trail and to get the record. And so I think like that morning, like I knew how much I wanted it. I knew how much I wanted to do it for her. And I was pretty miserable and pretty tired, but those weren't things that were going to make me like take a leisurely day in the Olalle camp area.
Because you really couldn't, you know, if you were going to do this record, I mean, there's no real
breaks.
There
wasn't a lot of wiggle room
there.
Like,
you can't just stop and, like, even rest for, like, a few 3-4 hours, because, I mean, you have to make up miles with every, like, minute, essentially. You got to just kind of keep going, right?
Yeah. I mean, the nice thing about doing a multi-day trail effort is it's different than, like, if I'm going to go out and race a 100-miler, where it starts and finishes in one push, and whoever makes it to the finish line first is the winner. And like each day didn't feel like that, because if I was a little bit slower during the day, as long as I made my miles and then kept going the next day, I was doing what I needed to do to stay on record pace. So there was some relaxation in being able to like stop and sit down and change up my shoes and have a snack and not think that it was putting me back by like minutes. But once it got toward the end and knowing like if I don't stay on my mileage goal, it does like put me back. Like if I hadn't kept going for that 10 miles through Mount Jefferson Wilderness, like I would not have made the record. And so it was, there's definitely some pressure with that.
Well, one of the things that you talked about, especially towards the end, as things are really getting tough, was that, I mean, you're raising money for this amazing cause, the Brave Like Gabe Foundation and Rare Cancer Research. So how much had you checked in with that? And like, were you checking in on how much money you were making or who was commenting, or were you watching that very carefully?
Somewhat, yes, especially at the end. I mean, there definitely was. So there was like a day in there somewhere. I'm trying to remember which day it was, but my friend Rachel, who does this kind of stuff for a living, she's very involved in nonprofits and fundraising, and she like took over my Instagram and started helping to build the momentum behind it. So some of it was out of my hands, but I, especially on the last day, the record was within reach when I woke up on day 8, and I decided to post on Instagram that I was like, I don't think I had shared that I was going for the overall record. And I did that morning. I was like, I'm going for the overall record. I have this many hours and this many miles to do that. Can you help me get there with donations to Brave Like Gabe? And that day was like the most phenomenal thing I've ever experienced in terms of people, just the outpouring of support and love for Rare Cancer Research and Brave Like Gabe. When I woke up that morning, I can't remember the exact numbers, but I want to say that I'd raised like $14,000. And by the time I reached the Bridge of the Gods, it was almost $30,000. And that day I was like, I don't tend to look at my phone on trail, but I was refreshing like every time I got service, or like I would come into a cruise stop and my crew would be like, you're up to $27,000. And that helped me so much that day, to just feel how much people were inspired to support this amazing cause that was so, my mother passed away from rare cancer, and so it was so linked to both my mom and to Gabe Grunewald, and it was phenomenal to like be watching that on the show. That boosted me a lot that day.
So, you know, you get past, you know, the Mount Hood area, you're heading towards the gorge. How did you feel? And like, you know, because you're doing a couple different things, you're coming towards the end of this long journey, but you're also chasing this record. I mean, did you feel pressure? Did you feel good? Did you feel nervous? Like, how'd you feel on that final stretch?
Yes. yeah, the final stretch was really emotional. It was also really hard. You would think at some point you would feel like you were almost there when you proportionally have like 10 miles compared to 460 miles. But the last day, and especially once it got dark, was just so hard. The descent into the Bridge of the Gods was so hard. So I definitely felt a lot of just like and I was just like ready to break. Like I had just run across the state of Oregon in just over a week. So I was physically and emotionally and mentally exhausted. But I was also at the culmination of this incredible thing. And I'm watching the support come in from Brave Like Gabe. I'm thinking about my mom this entire time. I hadn't talked to anyone about plans for the last day, because I didn't want to count on when I would be done. And, but I had so many friends show up who just really wanted to be there. And so as I got closer and closer to the Bridge of the Gods, I started just seeing these like clusters of headlamps of all these people who were waiting there at like midnight to cheer me across the Bridge of the Gods. People would surprise me, people who I knew would be there, just but like so much love as I came into the Bridge of the Gods and support. And so I was just, I felt like everything as I finished, like the relief to be done, the joy to be done, the just like both grief for my mom and also like feeling so close to her through this journey and the celebration of it. It was just, I think like every emotion I could have, I had as I got into the Bridge of the Gods.
And did you know by, because you beat the record, like the overall record, by a pretty substantial amount. I mean, did you know where you were and like what your time was versus whatever? Like how close were you tracking that?
Yeah, I knew. I felt pretty confident going into the day that I could do it. Like I felt like as long as I don't roll an ankle and have to like handstand my way into the Bridge of the Gods, it felt like it was within reach. But I was definitely aware of it, and I definitely like, while I felt like it was within reach, it also felt like you still have to maintain this like, you know, steady progress toward and still cover this ground, which I think was about 60 miles on the last day, like maybe just under. So I would say that I felt like I could do it, but also it did not feel like I had done it until I like got to the Bridge of the Gods.
Yeah, because I remember you saying that like, you know, you thought it was within reach, but then for a normal person, like it's like, oh, but you have to run 60 miles,
right?
Which 99% of the population would be like, you could put a gun to the back of me. I couldn't run 60 miles. I just couldn't do it. So,
right. It was, no, I don't want to dismiss the last day as like it was anything other than still a lot of ground to cover before getting there.
So you pulled this off, like this just gigantic feat. You know, what was the feeling like? Was it relief at the end? Was it pride? Like, I mean, how did you feel in the days after it?
Yeah. I mean, like, I think in the beginning of the conversation, you asked if it had sunk in yet. And I feel like it still hasn't fully, and I still haven't fully processed everything that I feel about it. But I think, yeah, it felt, it felt like just like crossing the bridge, there were so many emotions that that bubbled up from doing it. I mean, I think there's still some of like disbelief of like, did I do that thing, or did someone else like like body double for me across the state of Oregon? And also like for sure the gratitude of being able to do it. I think like I was so overwhelmed by the support I got both from friends and loved ones, and then also the support I got just from everyone who was following the run and everyone who donated to Brave Like Gabe. And that was such a phenomenal thing to be feeling. And yes, of course, like some pride of like, I can't believe I did this thing, this really big thing, and excitement for that. And and then of course like there was a lot of sadness over the reality of like the person who would be the proudest is my mom, and not being able to like call her up and tell her all about it was a super hard emotion to sit with right after it. So yeah, there was just all of the emotions. It was a very emotional thing.
All right. So, I mean, you did this thing that is just mind blowing. I mean, would you undertake another challenge like this, or was this your thing? Or like, have you set up like, would you run the entire PCT, or like, have you thought of other goals?
Yeah, no, I would definitely do another big challenge. I have to admit, I'm a little like lost as to how to follow the run, because it was so special and so wonderful. And there's a little bit of like, just, but like I don't have the words right now even. Yeah. It's just like, where do you go from there? A run that was so special for so many reasons, of being like this really emotional thing, and then also like a really incredible physical feat, and doing it in a place that's so special and meaningful for me. Like, where do you go from there? I don't know. I definitely want to, I will say that like a thing that I have felt in the wake of doing it is definitely a curiosity and an excitement about what else can I do. I think that's one of the reasons we like do this stuff, is because once we do it, we're like, cool, like what next, like what else? I don't know what that is yet, but I'm definitely curious and excited to explore more.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. It was really fun to kind of, you know, take this journey with you a little bit in writing about it. And it was definitely inspiring. I didn't really know that it was possible to run that many miles over mountains, down rivers and stuff like that in a day. So cool. Thanks for sharing your story. And thanks for taking some time.
Yeah. Thank you, Zach.
All right. Well, that's about all the time we have left in today's show. If you liked what you've heard, check out our catalog of more than 60 episodes featuring Oregon's most beautiful and interesting places at statesmanjournal.com/explore, along with Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. We'd once again like to thank our sponsors, beginning with the American Forest Resources Council. AFRC supports responsible forestry on public lands throughout the Pacific Northwest for our environment, for our economy, and for the future. Learn more at amforests.org. We'd also like to thank Visit Tillamook Coast. If you want to plan a trip out there, you can check out their outdoor recreation map that shows all the places to hike, swim, boat, and camp. You can find that map at tillamookcoast.com/recreation-map. Once again, that's tillamookcoast.com/recreation-map. And thanks to the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, which stresses the importance of recreating responsibly and leaving no trace in Oregon's outdoors. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us next time for the next edition of the Explore Oregon podcast.